this is a lengthy argument. And I'm going to call the roster in the order in which they will appear, and if I'm incorrect, you will advise me so to know who's talking at any one time. First, we will hear from Ms. Husser, representing Aurora Medical. That will be 25 minutes, 10 minutes by Richard Moriarty, introducing Ellen Beard, who will represent the United States Department of Labor. We will then hear from Jeffrey Sweetland of the Schneidman Law Firm. Did I do that right? Then Mr. Moriarty will appear again on behalf of the Department of Workforce Development and Equal Rights. And then Ms. Husser will have 15 minutes in a rebuttal and in response to the Department of Labor. Got it? All right. We will now hear 98-1546, Aurora Medical Group versus Department of Workforce Development. Ms. Husser.
Good morning. My name is Carmela Husser, and this is my colleague, Mary Pat Miniman from Quarles and Brady. And we represent Aurora Medical Group, who is the petitioner, appellant petitioner in this case. There's only one issue before the court this morning, and that is an issue of statewide importance to both employers and employee groups. And that is whether ERISA preempts Ms. Meyer's claim under the Wisconsin Family and Medical Leave Act, which I'll call the Wisconsin FMLA, to substitute accrued paid sick leave provided under Aurora's ERISA plan for unpaid leave provided by the Wisconsin FMLA, even though she was not sick at the time she took leave for the adoption of her child, and therefore was not an eligible beneficiary under the plan. Aurora contends that this court should find that ERISA preempts Ms. Meyer's state law claim for three reasons. First, the substitution provision of the Wisconsin FMLA is precisely the type of law that the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly found is preempted by ERISA because it interferes with the structure and the administration of an ERISA-covered plan.
Well, counsel, the ERISA-covered plan you assert is the Aurora plan.
Yes.
The sick leave plan.
Yes, Your Honor.
I read both the Department of Labor amicus brief and the AFL-CIO amicus brief, and both of them raise a question as to whether or not the plan is an ERISA plan.
Yes.
Now, that was a stipulation, as I understand it.
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
Your supplemental brief to the amicus brief indicates that this is a stipulation of fact.
Yes.
And how can that be a stipulation of fact? You're stipulating that certain facts meet a legal criteria. And that ordinarily, as I understand it, is a question of law for the court rather than a stipulation for the parties.
What I may have characterized that incorrectly. What I intended to convey to the court is that in order for anyone, for the court to determine whether it's an ERISA-covered plan or not an ERISA-covered plan, to determine that question of law, which I agree with the court on that you have to have some underlying facts. And there are no underlying facts in the record of this case.
Well, are we then here prematurely? That ought to send shivers up everybody's spine.
Well, I would suggest no, Your Honor, because that really isn't the issue of statewide importance here. The issue that everybody's waiting to hear an answer to is whether ERISA preempts Wisconsin's substitution provision under the Wisconsin FMLA. And as I pointed out in my supplemental brief, Mr. Sweetland did have the opportunity to look at the underlying facts, and he made that stipulation with knowledge of what he was doing. Also, of course, we would contend that the IRS has approved this as an ERISA-covered plan, and they have joint joint enforcement over ERISA with the Department of Labor. And we contend that the ALJ's decision in Sishon was based on a lack of a full knowledge of the plan.
What do we do? It concerns me what I would call this threshold issue. To me, it could be like an advisory opinion. That is, assuming that this plan or this payment, claims payment agreement, comes under ERISA, Wisconsin Supreme Court, assume that legal determination, and we'll stipulate to that, regardless of whether it's legally correct, we'll stipulate to that. Then Wisconsin Supreme Court opine, if you will, on an issue not only of statewide import, but that this is a case of some magnitude. I'm concerned that we should build this house on such an infirm foundation that may be illegally, that may be legally incorrect. Can you help me with that? I mean, why should we get to first base on this case?
Well, in the first place, that there is nothing in the record upon which the court could make any other determination, because there are not facts in the record from this case or the Sishon case in which you could make a determination that this is not an ERISA-covered plan. And for that reason, I think it makes sense to go forward.
Let's say we had in a criminal case, the state and the defense got together and they said, let's stipulate that the Miranda warnings were given. And let's appeal this, were not given. Let's stipulate that the Miranda warnings were not given. And let's appeal this case and take it to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And Wisconsin Supreme Court, would you decide the issue of whether or not, you know, the evidence has to be suppressed in Miranda? But in reality, they were given. Should we take that case because the parties want to stipulate to something that may or may not be factually or legally correct? I'm pushing you on this just because for me it's an important threshold question.
Well, for us, of course, if it were going to be an important threshold question, we would have put the evidence in the record to prove our case. So we feel there's some basic unfairness if the court would decide this wasn't an ERISA-covered plan. We haven't had an opportunity to make a record. Well, however, I think the Department of Labor has suggested that the court could say, given if this is an ERISA-covered plan, here's what we would decide in regard to whether ERISA preempts the substitution claim. That would not put the court in the position of saying, yes, Aurora's plan specifically is an ERISA-covered plan. Because maybe the objections that could slide this into a non-ERISA-covered plan are some objections that are easily overcome by administrators of those plans. So I think the court could still safely make a determination without putting the court in the position of agreeing to something that they don't have all the facts on.
And that's important. I'm talking about whether this is or is not a ERISA plan, because clearly, at least as I look at the federal, at the Family Medical Leave Act, the federal and not the state, that they say that nothing in this act or by any amendment shall be construed to supersede any provision of any state or local law that provides greater medical leave rights. The reason this ERISA thing is important, whether this is, because clearly in Wisconsin at least there would be these more generous rights. Substitution would clearly be available for non-ERISA employers. So the key here is whether you fit in under ERISA, whether you are, you know, that type of plan. And that's why it's very important.
It is important, but also just like to course, you're dealing with the case before you, but there are many employers who have ERISA-covered plans, and ERISA-covered plans cover a broad range of all pension plans and all employee welfare plans that are covered by ERISA, and that's anything from sickness and accident to life insurance to prepaid legal expenses. So there's a broad range of coverage here that's not just specific to Aurora's plan. So the legal issue of whether ERISA preempts the Wisconsin substitution claim is still very important, and I assume that is the one that would encourage the court to take this case, not whether Aurora met the threshold of an ERISA-covered plan.
Well, I think that we've at least raised that as an issue. We have not answered it, so we should move on to the preemption issues.
Thank you,
Your
Honor.
Thank you.
Counsel, as you move on to the preemption issue, I've been thinking about a case that was decided by this court about 3 years ago, the Miller Brewing Company case. Now, that's a case that, as I remember, presents a somewhat similar fact situation. It quite obviously involved different provisions of law. But the basic principles in regard to preemption are discussed in Miller. And the one that really sticks with me is the presumption against preemption. How do you believe that you'll overcome that presumption?
As you know, the United States Supreme Court has addressed the phrase in the ERISA preemption clause that says any plan that relates to an ERISA-covered plan is preempted. And the court has been come somewhat disenchanted with how to interpret the term relate to. So what the court has done is said that the presumption against preemption is overcome if the plan in question interferes with the structure and administration of an ERISA-covered plan. And that was announced in the Travelers case and again repeated in the Dillingham case. And the court said that in order to find out if the presumption against preemption is overcome, the court has to go beyond the text of ERISA and look to the objectives of the ERISA statute as a guide to the scope of the state law that Congress would have supposed would survive ERISA preemption, and look at the impact of the state law on ERISA plans. And when you do that, when you look at the purpose behind ERISA, and then look at the impact of the substitution provision on ERISA-covered plans, you can see that the substitution provision is the type of law that the U.S. Supreme Court would have found would be preempted. And here is why. If you look at the drafting of the substitution provision of the Wisconsin FMLA, it says that an employee may substitute for any other paid or unpaid leave provided by the employer, may substitute for unpaid family and medical leave provided under the Wisconsin FMLA, any other paid or unpaid leave provided by the employer. And paid or unpaid leave can be non-ERISA plans and ERISA-covered plans. And this court in the Richland decision in interpreting the substitution provision said that the employee has the power and discretion to decide whether to use the paid leave or the unpaid leave. And I don't think we came up with too many examples of unpaid leave, so mostly we're talking about paid leave. So this court said that the employee had the discretion and took it out of the hands of the plan fiduciary, which is what ERISA would require the plan fiduciary to manage the assets only for the beneficiaries of the plan. And by saying that, this court also, in interpreting the law, showed that if Ms. Myers, who is not a beneficiary of the plan, can come in and claim assets of the plan which are to be held for the beneficiaries, that in fact she takes a responsibility that belongs to the fiduciary or the administrator of the plan, And she also is allowed then to change the terms of the plan.
Well, everything that you have said to this point, and maybe I'm interrupting you at the absolute point, and if I am, I apologize. Everything you've said to this point seems to me to make the point that this is another way of overcoming the presumption, but nevertheless, a presumption always will lie against those that seek the preemption.
Yes, and in the Supreme Court decisions, there's always been that threshold that the petitioner has to meet, that there is a presumption against preemption. The court, Congress, doesn't intend to take over the state's power to legislate in areas that traditionally have been legislated in by the state, such as minimum wage laws or prevailing wage laws or those kinds of things. But the court, in saying that the presumption against there is a presumption against preemption, the court has drawn a line and specifically talks about where should we draw the line. In the Travelers case and the Dillingham case, it talks about where do we draw the line. And in 11 of the last 17 cases from 1981 to 1999, the court has found in 11 of those 18 or 19 cases that the presumption was overcome, sometimes in a portion of the state law, sometimes for the whole state law. So it's not that the presumption can't be overcome, and that's why the court says what we're going to say now, because we don't like the term relate to, is we're going to look at the purpose of ERISA. The purpose of ERISA, in this case, is to provide a uniform structure for administering benefits. And we have to remember that ERISA, if we go back to the purpose of ERISA, it was a law, a major piece of labor legislation, which was to help employees. And it was the impetus for that was the abuse in pension plans. And some of you may remember the name of Jacob Javits, who was a New York senator who fought. And this legislation was introduced in the Kennedy administration, wasn't passed until Gerald Ford was president. It was hailed as a monumental piece of labor legislation for employees. And just as a matter of public policy, I don't think the court would want to drive a truck through the protections that ERISA provides, particularly if you think that ERISA covers not only employee welfare plans like sick plans, which might seem like a little exception, but it covers pension plans. As I was walking over here, I saw a big headline, Gore criticizes Bush on pension plans. Nothing is more sacred to employees than their pension plan. And ERISA was meant to protect employees from abuses of pension plans. And if you open the door in the Wisconsin substitution provision, you open the door for every state, 50 states, to come in and make laws that affect pension plans and other employee welfare benefit plans. That was the purpose of ERISA preemption. The Congress said at that time, we don't want states to be able to do that, because if employers are subject to 50 different regulations of their benefit plans, they won't provide the benefits.
But that's not really so, is it, Ms. Houston? I mean, we're not arguing here about a state law that provides lesser benefits. We're arguing here about a state law that provides greater benefits. And no one is making the argument, as far as I can tell, that a state has a right to provide for lesser benefits.
Well, let me explain how it works, in my opinion. With the substitution provision, the employee can decide to use a body of funds that were set aside for people who are sick. And it provides a greater benefit for that particular employee. But the whole concept of this uniform regulation of benefits plans is that companies make an actuarial guess as to who is going to need the benefit. And then that benefit is put aside in a plan, which becomes then protected. So the employees get a benefit of that. If the somebody who's not a beneficiary of the plan is able to draw down on a plan, that can affect the other beneficiaries. And particularly, and I think it becomes clearer, if you look at a pension plan, where, say, a company puts in a percentage of its gross profits into the pension plan and says, all right, for all of you who have worked so many hours in a year, you get a percentage of this pot. If someone who is not a beneficiary of that plan, who doesn't meet the requirements, can come in and draw down on that, maybe that person gets a greater benefit, but everybody else loses. And the result of that is the rush to the bottom that the manufacturers talked about in their amicus brief, that employers may be encouraged not to expand benefits for employees, but to decrease benefits for employees. That's what ERISA was concerned with. And that's what the Supreme Court talks about when it talks about why you can't get into the administration of an ERISA-covered plan. The state of Wisconsin and any other...
Sorry, is this a funded plan or unfunded?
Self-insured.
Okay, so you don't have a fund sitting there that's drawn down. It's just the general assets of the corporation.
No, it's not from the general assets. No, Your Honor, just the opposite. I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. It is, they make an actuarial guess. The plan makes an actuarial guess as to how many people are going to need sick leave benefits. And then that amount is deposited into the fund. And, of course, it's an aggregate of funds. It's not like you get $50 and you get $25. It's an aggregate.
It's funded.
Right.
Okay.
It's funded in that way, yes. But if it would just be actually poor public policy if the court were to decide that the federal FMLA made a huge exception to ERISA preemption, a huge exception that doesn't appear any place in the federal FMLA, talks nothing about ERISA preemption, and said that states can indiscriminately change the terms of or the administration of ERISA-covered plans. That would work against the interests of employees who are the beneficiaries of that plan. And when you look at the legislative history of the federal FMLA, if you look at the statute, there's nothing about ERISA preemption. When you look at the legislative history, it's inconsistent because there is legislative history on the Senate side, but if you look at the House side, there is no comparable legislative history. As a matter of fact, it's stark in its divergence from the Senate report. The Senate report talks twice about no preemption by any other federal law or no preemption by ERISA. The House report is stark in its absence of that language. So we can't say it was the intent of Congress to make an exception to ERISA preemption for laws as broad as pension and employee welfare benefit laws.
Counsel, is it stipulated or is it a matter of record that Ms. Myers is not a beneficiary of the plan?
When I say that she's not a beneficiary of the plan, I mean that because she is not fit, she doesn't meet the qualifications of the plan, she's not a beneficiary. If she were sick, she would be a beneficiary of the plan.
Is she a participant in the plan?
It doesn't work that way. Aurora provides sick leave benefits, and there's an aggregated fund. And when somebody gets sick, they're entitled to a portion of those aggregated funds for sick pay.
Any employee?
Pardon?
Any employee, I think.
Any employee who accrues leave, who meets the requirements of accruing leave.
So you're saying she's not a beneficiary of the plan because she wasn't ill?
Yes. That's right. She doesn't meet the terms of the plan, so she's not a beneficiary in that respect.
What happens if you lose, therefore your actuarial figures were not correct, apparently? Does the corporation put in more money the next time to meet the needs?
I really couldn't answer that, Your Honor. I mean, one option would be to put in more money the next time. Another option would be to decrease benefits. A third option could be that, you know, any employer can take the funds out of their general assets. And any state, by the way, can pass a law requiring employers to provide a benefit. And where the law doesn't distinguish where it has to come from, doesn't get involved in the ERISA-covered plan. So you can, the state can pass minimum labor standards, as they always have had the right to do, and the Supreme Court has consistently said they have a right to do that. But the only thing that the state can't do is they can't get in and draft the law in such a way that meddles with an ERISA-covered plan. And the way the Wisconsin substitution provision is drafted, it crosses that line where between a minimum labor standard, where the state might have said everybody has to pay for FMLA leave, to saying, giving the employee the power to get in and determine who should get the benefits and giving the employer the power to be the beneficiary. I'd like to say one thing about the legislative history also, because I think when we get to whether the federal FMLA preempts ERISA because there is no language in the statute, the respondents have encouraged this court to look to the legislative history. And besides looking at the two committee reports, which are inconsistent, there is the colloquy in the Senate by Senators Dodd, Feingold, and Cole. And that was cited by Judge Evans in the unpublished Bean decision, and it's been cited by the lower courts. And that is true that it is there, but that standing by itself is not enough where there is contrary legislative history on the House side, because we have to look at the intent. The Mackey case in the Supreme Court says that you have to look to the intent of the Congress that passed the law to determine what the intent of Congress was. And the intent of Congress that passed the law is at best unclear, and a colloquy in the Senate before the passage of the federal FMLA does not overcome that inconsistent legislative history. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Huser, and you have another 15 minutes
for rebuttal.
Mr. Moriarty, we're going to introduce Helen Beard, Washington.
Morning, Your Honors. I'm Assistant Attorney General Richard Browse Moriarty, representing the Department of Workforce Development. It's my pleasure to introduce Ellen L. Beard, a senior appellate attorney with the United States Department of Labor. Ms. Beard argues frequently in federal courts, but I understand this is her first opportunity to argue before a state Supreme Court, and she couldn't have chosen better. Thank you very much, and I introduce Ms. Beard.
Ms. Beard, you are not a member of the Wisconsin Bar.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So you're appearing on pro hoc vici, that is, for one appearance.
Yes.
All right, Ms. Beard.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to give you a hard time.
May it please the Court. The Department of Labor has asked to participate in this case for two reasons. First, because we have a policy interest in discouraging employers as well as insurers and HMOs from claiming to operate ERISA plans to avoid complying with state law when they really are not operating ERISA plans at all. Second, we have an interest in making sure that ERISA preemption does not impair the policies of the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act to preserve more generous state family and medical leave laws, such as Wisconsin's leave substitution provision. In this case, applying ERISA preemption requires a three-step analysis, which we have set out in our brief. The first step is determining whether Aurora has an ERISA plan. And as the Chief Justice has pointed out, this is really a question of federal law. It's not a fact that can be stipulated by the parties. We merely brought it to the court's attention to point out that there may be a threshold issue here based on the findings of fact that were made by a Wisconsin ALJ in, I was calling it the Keyshone case. I'm not quite sure how it's pronounced. But I think it raised doubts anyway about whether the way the Aurora plan is operated is consistent with the notion of having a separate funded plan that pays the benefits, which would be covered by ERISA, or whether it's really more like the employer simply paying sick leave out of its general assets, which would be an exempt payroll practice under our regulations.
And the truth is, we don't know on this record.
That's true, Your Honor. So it's entirely up to this court what to do with this situation, whether you treat it as waived, whether you remand it for further development, or whether you simply decide to decide the case on other grounds.
What would be the impact? Let's just assume in the wildest reaches of our imagination that this question, this case could be appealed to the United States Supreme Court. What would be the impact, in your judgment, on the federal court if in fact we didn't resolve this question? Would they take it? Would they look
well,
at the stance?
I believe
it's in everybody's interest to get the fundamental.
If the court asked the views of the United States about whether it should take cert in this case, I think we would probably say no, first of all, because there would not be a conflict in the circuits. This is the first time the issue has really arisen in terms of the relationship between a state law and the federal FEMLA. But we might also say that there was a threshold issue which was not addressed here, which might be an additional reason for the court not to grant cert. I mean, those are the kinds of considerations, obviously, that the court would look at.
Counsel, just so I understand, I don't want to dwell on this, but just so I understand the threshold issue, in that CICHON case, the ALJ, the administrative law judge, found that there was a payment of these benefits out of the general fund. Under Aurora's sick leave plan, Aurora's pay employees sick pay benefits out of its general assets, and there's the risk that the sick pay fund will be unable to reimburse Aurora. In other words, they put money in one fund, and their finding was that there was no guarantee if that fund, I think that First Star was going to M&I, if that fund would have sufficient assets to pay, and so it might be taken out of the general assets. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, well, there were two factors that the ALJ relied on. And there was a fund, and Aurora would transfer money into that fund every quarter and try to estimate how much money would be needed for that quarter, and then the assets would drop down close to zero, and then it would transfer some more money the next quarter. But what happened, the money sort of went back and forth between Aurora and the fund. And the actual paychecks to the employees, according to the ALJ, were cut from a payroll account at a different bank, not the fund trustee. And they included both regular salary and sick pay, so that literally the money was coming from Aurora's general assets. Then the other factor was, that was sort of the mechanics, then the other factor was, you know, what was the economic reality here? Who actually bore the risk of non-payment, which is an issue that the Supreme Court talked about in Marash. And the ALJ thought that given the way this thing operated on a number of factors, that Aurora essentially bore the risk of non-payment rather than the separate fund.
Right. Down to or up to preemption?
Yes.
Second issue.
Step two is whether, assuming you have an ERISA plan, determining whether the state law relates to that plan within the meaning of ERISA's preemption provision. And
your time is so short, and I'm very anxious to hear what you have to say with respect to the burden who carries the presumption of no preemption.
Well, we actually agree with Aurora that if FEMLA did not exist, that ERISA would preempt the state law. And I think we've set that analysis out in our brief. I hate to spend too much time on it, but there's a two-part test. There's a reference test. There's a connection test. We think here the reference test is not met because the Wisconsin law simply talks about leave, which could be a payroll practice. But we think the connection test is met because if you really have an ERISA plan, as we understand the Wisconsin law, it's changing the terms of the plan. It's saying that people are eligible for sick leave to adopt a child when the plan itself says they're only eligible for sick leave when they're sick. And we think under the even the more recent Supreme Court cases that have cut back on the periphery of ERISA preemption, that this would still be preempted.
But then we come to your third argument.
Then we come to the third argument, which is probably the meatiest and the one that the parties have spent the most time discussing. And that is whether the Federal Savings Clause in ERISA saves the state law from ERISA preemption because ERISA preemption would impair the goal of the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act.
Is there a presumption that attaches to that issue?
Well, I think there's a general presumption against preemption, which is sort of in the background of all the analysis. There's also the general notion that congressional intent is the touchstone of preemption analysis. So those are kind of the background principles. But I think
so here, the issue is whether to find a clear and manifest purpose.
I don't think that is the issue, Your Honor. That's the issue if you're doing some sort of implied repeal analysis, or if you're asking whether FEMLA amended ERISA. And we don't think that FEMLA necessarily amended ERISA. We don't think it had to, because you already had the Federal Savings Clause in ERISA itself, which says that ERISA will not impair any other federal law. And the Supreme
past law, future law,
both, I think.
That's 1144D. You're
yeah, 514D, 1144D. And the Supreme Court has defined impair broadly in cases like Shaw, which was an ERISA case, and Humana, which is also cited in our brief. It means to frustrate the goal of or affect in an injurious manner the declared policy of another law. You can, even if you don't have a direct conflict between two laws, one of them can impair the other. And here we agree with Aurora that there's not a direct conflict between any provision of ERISA and any provision of FEMLA. But we think that ERISA preemption here would frustrate the goal of FEMLA to preserve more generous state leave laws. And we also think that the text of FEMLA is ambiguous on the issue of ERISA preemption, which allows you to go to the legislative history, which we think is pretty clear. If you look at sections 401B and 402B of FEMLA, which is 2651B, 2652B in the code, each one of them is phrased in terms of this act, which talks about FEMLA. So you could read them narrowly if you read them in isolation. On the other hand, you could read them together to mean that one of the rights established under FEMLA is the preservation of more generous state laws whose protections cannot be diminished by an ERISA plan. And in particular, 402B is not limited to rights established under Title I of FEMLA, which is the part of FEMLA that establishes the specific federal leave rights. It's broader than that. It talks about rights established under this act. So it certainly could include the right to more generous state leave benefits. You could also read Section 402B as aimed directly at protecting state laws, because the federal rights in FEMLA are already protected by ERISA's Federal Savings Clause. So this 402B wouldn't really have a purpose unless it was to protect the more generous state laws. I think my time has expired, so I would just encourage the court to...
You may have a couple of more minutes. Just finish your argument.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. So So for these reasons, as I said, we think that the text of FEMLA is ambiguous on the issue of ERISA preemption. We think that ERISA preemption would impair the goals of FEMLA, which are stated in the statute itself. And because of those two factors, the court can look at the legislative history. And we think the legislative history is very clear, and I think the parties here will address this in more detail, but the Senate committee reports, both in 91 and 93, the colloquy on the Senate floor.
What delay is that? What did the Senate report? I was not all that impressed with the Cole Feingold thing. I mean, it's like a put-up job to me.
They were talking to Senator Dodd.
We see more and more attempts to influence that by inserting things into the record, but maybe the Senate committee reports might give us a little bit better insight. What do they show?
Well, I think the language is in all the briefs, but they talk specifically about ERISA preemption and say that the purpose is that the rights that the state, the more generous state leave rights, will not be affected either by FEMLA itself or by ERISA or any other federal law. And the House material that Aurora has talked about, it's not actually a House committee report. It's a letter from the Congressional Research Service that was inserted into the congressional record as additional remarks. It doesn't really have the status of an official committee report at all. Just to wrap up, it's our position that the court should either affirm the decision below on the ground that ERISA preemption would impair the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act, or the court should vacate and remand for additional proceedings on the threshold coverage issue.
Thank you, Ms. Beard.
Thank you.
We will next hear from Mr. Sweetland. Mr. Sweetland. You're representing...
Yes, Your Honor, I am representing Christine Myers, the employee, who is here seated behind our table with her husband. May it please the court, my name is Jeffrey Sweetland of the law firm of Schneidman Myers. We should make no mistake about it, that if this court concludes that Aurora is right and that ERISA does preempt Wisconsin's FMLA in this situation, employers all over Wisconsin will load their sick leave into ERISA plans for the sole purpose of evading their employees' broad substitution rights under Wisconsin's FMLA. We heard quite a bit of argument from the other side a few moments ago about how allowing Wisconsin substitution rights to apply in this situation would drive a big truck through ERISA and lead to a race to the bottom. And encourage states to interfere with ERISA in all sorts of ways. That argument is turning the actual situation here on its head. What we have is a situation of ERISA being used specifically to circumvent, to evade Wisconsin substitution law. Now, as Ms. Myers' case is a very clear demonstration. Ms. Myers and her husband were adopting a child in early 97. And she went to her employer, Aurora, and said, I want to take Wisconsin family medical leave. to cover my absence. And I want to take that so that I can enjoy the broader substitution rights of the Wisconsin Act, because I don't have enough vacation to cover the entire leave. And I want my entire leave to be paid, and so I want to use my accrued sick leave to cover my leave. And Aurora said, no, 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 you can't do that. We'll let you take the time off. We'll let you use your vacation and your holiday pay, but your sick leave, no. That we've put that in an ERISA plan. And so we don't have to comply with the Wisconsin FMLA as construed in Richland School District with respect to our sick leave, because ours is an ERISA plan. This is not driving a truck through ERISA. And counsel for the Department of Labor hit it right on the head when she said the answer to this question is in, not in ERISA, not in the Wisconsin FMLA, it is in the federal FMLA. And would ERISA preemption in this situation impair the purposes of the federal FMLA, and we submit that it would. Certainly we don't point to a clear and unmistakable provision of the federal FMLA that says specifically there is no ERISA preemption. There isn't such a phrase. If there were, we would not be here. Just as we would not be here if the federal FMLA said absolutely and positively ERISA preemption still applies to state FMLAs. But we have a policy of the federal FMLA embodied in 401B that encourages states to develop more generous leave rights than those contained, more generous family and medical leave rights than those contained in the federal FMLA. And the federal FMLA's leave rights include the substitution rights. And those substitution rights are not as good for the employees as are Wisconsin's. Federal substitution provisions say that you can't use, that does not authorize the substitution of sick leave, any kind of sick leave, for birth or adoption leave.
What was the effect of the passage of the federal family leave law on Wisconsin's law?
Well, we submit that the federal law, the only effect that the federal law's enactment on Wisconsin law would have, well, two things. One is that it, we submit that it eliminated all other federal preemption of Wisconsin law, and that any federal impact on Wisconsin law is to be viewed through 401B of the federal FMLA, which says that nothing in this act or in any amendment made by this act will supersede any state law that provides greater family and medical leave rights. And so in that sense, it preserved anything in Wisconsin family medical leave, in the Wisconsin FMLA, that provided greater leave rights to the employees.
Did the interplay of the two acts create any better benefits for people in Wisconsin in the state law?
It, I guess I'm sorry. What it specifically says is that it does not supersede any state law that provides greater family and medical leave rights. No specific reference to substitution, no specific reference to Wisconsin. I think what we see in this is a clear policy that says we encourage the states, we want the states to experiment with more generous laws, and that it is our intent that those laws, because they are laws within the field that this act, the federal FMLA, is addressing, those laws are not to be impeded by federal interference to the extent that they provide greater family and medical leave rights than this act does.
If there hadn't been a federal family leave law, would the Wisconsin law have been preempted by ERISA?
There was that, I guess the only decision that addressed that question was an ALJ decision back in 91 or 92, which said, yes, it did. I think that there was, certainly in a situation where ERISA plans are developed specifically for the purpose of evading the Wisconsin FMLA law, I would submit that there'd be an argument that the presumption against preemption was not met. But at this point, I'm just kind of hypothecating on what might have been, because we know that part of the stark reality right now is there is the federal FMLA. Everything that we are talking about as far as the events and so forth happened in the context, in the overall context of a Family Medical Leave Act regime governed at the federal level by the federal FMLA and at the state level by the Wisconsin FMLA, which was preserved as to its more generous benefit provisions by the federal.
I thought your answer to Justice Prass's question would be probably. There probably would be preemption. That's the way that I inferred from your argument, because the linchpin of your whole argument is the federal legislation, and my sense is that it follows from your argument.
My argument is not going to rest on the absence of ERISA preemption. Let me rephrase that, because my argument is not going to rest on the proposition that absent the federal leave law, there still would have been no ERISA preemption. But what we still have is an ambiguous statute. The federal FMLA, we have to admit it is ambiguous. What does 401B doesn't specifically say, what it means by any amendment made by this act. 402B doesn't say what it means by the rights established by this law. It doesn't specifically say what amendments are made by it. And Aurora, in its opening brief, commented on pages 18 and 19, all Congress had to do to protect greater benefits provided under state leave laws was to include some mention of ERISA or ERISA preemption in section 402B. And then in our brief, we pointed out, well, yes, they did mention ERISA in 402B because they referred to specifically to employee benefit plans, and the federal FMLA's definition of employee benefit plans specifically referred to ERISA. And then they said, well, wait a minute, that's not really what we meant. What we meant was that 402B refers only to amendments to plans, not to statutes. Well, if that's true, then the same applies to 401B, which would say any amendments to ERISA plans made by this act shall yield to state law. That, of course, assumes that plans can never supersede state law, which is a large assumption because under our federalism, only federal law can supersede state law. But all it goes back to is there's an ambiguity. There are many different ways of interpreting this law, and they're all different reasonable ways. And the only way that you can eliminate an ambiguity is to eliminate all other possible interpretations of statutory language so that you are just left with one, and we are not. And that brings us, that leaves us with an ambiguity, which requires us then to look beyond the statute itself and look to the legislative history. And that legislative history demonstrates, without a doubt, I would submit, that the extension of ERISA preemption to the Wisconsin FMLA to evade the broad substitution provisions of the Wisconsin FMLA clearly works an impairment of the federal FMLA in a way that is not permitted by Section 514D of ERISA. And I guess I've got a couple more minutes, but that wraps up my argument.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sweetland. We have approximately a half hour remaining with 15 minutes to Mr. Moriarty and 15 to Ms. Husser. Now, if the students have to leave, I don't know what your schedule is. Do you? Then we'll just take a moment recess, and we'll all stay at the bench, otherwise it becomes more than a moment. And we were delighted to have you all. You may leave. Don't feel that you're missing the end in the sense that you'll expect the court to decide the case, because it will not from the bench. So, and if you want to hear the arguments, you can hear it on internet in a couple of days, the remaining arguments. And you may then ultimately read the decision on our webpage. So thank you for coming, and you will return at about noon and meet with the Justice Sykes. You may tiptoe out. I assume the students in the back of the room are from Darlington High School business law students. Is that correct? Well, you're welcome, and thank you for coming. That was very quietly done, Mr. Moriarty. Assistant Attorney General, Department of Workforce Development, Equal Rights Division.
Thank you, Your Honor. Should I proceed?
Pardon me? Yes, you may.
Thank you. Despite the paper consumed, the issue is relatively simple. If Congress says federal preemption does not bar a state law claim, no court
much less a state court, should find that it does bar that claim. That's the issue. We have Congress in 1993 telling the world through the congressional record, through Senate reports, repeating what they said in 1991 over vigorous opposition, that any state or local family and medical leave provision that is more generous than the federal law is to be insulated from federal preemption. That's what Congress stated.
But do you agree with Ms. Baird? This is the same question I think Justice Prosser posed. Do you agree with Ms. Baird that ERISA preempts the State Leave Act and that you're saved by FEMA?
If we did not have the 1993 legislative history, I submit it would be a very difficult question and a close question. I don't know what the answer would be. I do know that the legislators in Wisconsin, when they were looking at the potential effect of ERISA, as indicated in the Lesser Common Law Review article that the court is twice or court cited, in that Lesser Law Review article, it was noted they were concerned about the effect of ERISA on health care benefits as far as the state law, but the substitution provision never even came into the scope until the Thompson decision in 1991 came down, which took people by surprise. The effect of ERISA preemption on substitution was not in the mix. Only twice, only two forums, have we been able to find the Thompson decision in 1991 by DWD, and then the New Jersey case that we cited in 1992, finding another type of provision, a family medical leave provision, preempted by ERISA. Those are the only two forums in the entire history of these laws that we've been able to find where ERISA preemption was found to bar such claims. So if it was so clear that it would bar these types of claims, I would think you would see a lot more developed law on that. I could create, as an advocate, coherent and multi-layered reasons why ERISA preemption might not apply to this provision, absent the legislative history. What the result of those arguments would be, I wouldn't know. I think the best summary is what Justice Bradley pointed out, though, probably. And that's why it is so important to look at what Congress did in 1993. You don't have to get into those troubling issues of what may be the law absent that legislative history.
Counsel, I want to follow up on the Chief's question. Are you, as you argue, in accord with the Department of Labor's position that there is preemption, but under the savings clause, it's saved? Or is your position, as you argue today, that there is no preemption based on the legislative history?
We do differ on our analysis. DWD takes the position, as expressed in its brief, that Aurora didn't prove there was ERISA preemption. I think, as I've just expressed, that there's good arguments that can be made it wouldn't, absent the 1993 history, but it would be a much closer case. I do not concur with the Department of Labor that it... And I've got some reasons for that. One is I disagree regarding the presumption and the effect of that presumption. And I think I'm backed up by the U.S. Supreme Court on that one. The presumption against preemption applies generally, and it is only overcome when Congress has expressed clear and manifest intent that the state statute be preempted. That's the Dillingham case. We cited it on page 15 of our brief and quoted it, and that's at 519 U.S. at 325 in the Dillingham case. Very clearly, the assumption is when you're dealing in fields of traditional state regulation, and we all agree on that, these are fields of traditional state regulation, both minimum labor standards and domestic relations. When you're dealing in that area, the assumption or presumption is that the historic police powers of the states were not to be superseded by the federal act unless that was the clear and manifest purpose of the Congress. Now,
that's right from what Clarence Thomas wrote, right?
He is quoting the Rice case from 1947,
right.
As well.
So that's the standard law. But in ERISA, you do have a clear and manifest purpose.
You have a clear and manifest purpose,
then it shall supersede any and all state laws insofar as they may now or hereafter relate to any employee benefit plan. So you've got a clear purpose superseding. The problem is the language is unclear.
The clear and manifest purpose in 1974, whatever it may be, was there. What effect that may or may not have had on this particular law is far less clear, and that's evidenced by the wealth of cases where the Supreme Court has had to try to figure out what exactly does that mean. I submit that
this is a statutory interpretation.
Right, but I mean, if it was clear and manifest, if the ERISA preemption statute was so clear and manifest that it automatically brought in all these state laws, then we wouldn't have all the cases that have had to try to interpret what does it mean here, what does it mean here, etc.
Ms. Moriarty, I'm not quite sure I understand your position. Let me phrase what I think I hear you say.
Okay.
Tell me if I'm right or wrong. That in 1973, arguably anyway, this was clear and manifest.
When ERISA was enacted. All right.
But when FEMLA was enacted in 1993, that created, that impacted on ERISA, creating an ambiguity, and the presumption comes back into play, and they have not overcome that.
That's, except for the fact that I don't know for sure that ERISA would preempt the law. Probably would, but I don't know if it would have absent the 1993. That's absolutely correct. And I the point is, and the court cases have been real clear on this, you don't look at the effect of the state law on ERISA rights or anything. You don't look at relation. Everything relates to everything. Everything's connected to everything. So we don't use those terms. I mean, we may use the terms, those labels, but that's not what we're really talking about. What we're talking about in the area of traditional state regulation particularly is, what did Congress really intend? And we've got that presumption that comes into play, and unless you've got the clear and manifest intent conveyed, preemption doesn't apply. Now, let's go with what you were saying. If, in fact, it was clear and manifest before 1974, it certainly was not after 1993. Congress came in and said, wait a minute, with these state family and medical leave laws, we've got a field that we think is important. We're going to set some standards, but we don't want that to be the defining set of standards. We want to not only recognize state laws, but encourage them and protect them from other federal preemptive sources. Why? The colloquy conveys that in fairly good detail. Now, how all that comes into play is the subject of law review articles. But under clear case law, under federal statutory construction principles, that colloquy, floor debate, asking for clarification just before a final vote is a valid indicia of statutory construction intent.
Are you finished? I don't want to interrupt.
And just one point, and I'll come right back. In that colloquy, they talked about encouraging state experimentation, and that's exactly what would be brought to a halt if preemption, in fact, applies. Yes, Your Honor.
I want to delicately ask this question because you've several times mentioned federal statutory construction principles, or this is a statutory interpretation case. The Labor Department is the federal agency responsible for interpreting and enforcing both ERISA and FEMLA. What deference should we give to the Department of Labor's interpretation?
In the brief and in the oral argument, or
everywhere.
If there were a declared U.S. DOL view on this issue, published through rule, etc., that would be one thing. Clearly, there's not, and one reason there's not is that was not within their jurisdiction. And Aurora made a point of, oh, you don't see in the rules a mention of ERISA preemption. Well, of course not. That's not something they were. They weren't talking about state and local laws in their rules. So of course you don't see it there. Should you accord deference to their views presented in the brief and argument? Certainly it's a studied view, and I think if it's persuasive, the court should look at it. But I don't think there's any requirement that that deference be granted in the same way, for example,
I would defer to you.
That I would defer to you.
I understand that fundamentally. But, of course, an analogous situation is a workers' comp case that we have.
Sure.
And the department comes in and says, look, we're charged with interpreting the statute, and we as a court can say, well, you've done it a lot. Even though you don't have a declared policy, and you can't turn to the front page
right.
and say that's the declared policy, okay, we say you have great weight deference, or you have, you know, due deference, or whatever mm-hmm. the different kind of deferences are. I mean, isn't this analogous to the kind of approach that we would give in a state case? Do we owe the Department of Labor interpretation of FEMLA and ERISA some deference?
I really can't say whether you should or shouldn't based on the law, but quite frankly, I think their views are very important and persuasive. One reason I suggested to the court that it might be appropriate to allow oral argument, and I appreciate that. It took me a little aback, quite frankly, that the conclusion they reached on what if the legislative history was not present. But I do think that ultimately the conclusion they reached, that the FEMLA history makes it clear that Congress intended to insulate these provisions from preemption, is an important one and should be viewed as one reached by the U.S. Department of Labor. Obviously they did. And whether deference is due is the issue.
If the presumption is against preemption, then you don't even have to make it clear, do you? Because Myers wins all ties.
Correct. Correct, and that's the point here. For Aurora to win, they have to prove there was clear and manifest intent to preempt. And what do we have here? In 1993, obviously ambiguous statutory language, which means what? You get into the legislative history. Once you get into that history, how could Congress have been clear? We intend to exempt, to insulate these provisions. In the Senate report, which you asked about earlier, for example, the Senate report made it very clear. We intend by 401B to be protecting all these more generous state provisions from preemption by this law and any other law. That's what the Senate report said. And it didn't just say it in 1993, it said it in 1991 as well. That caused enormous opposition from opponents to the law in 1991, and it was when it was vetoed, then that's where the law lay. Came back in 1993, the same thing happened. This wasn't a big surprise. Everyone knew this was the intent of the sponsors. Now, Aurora says, why, if what happened here is they just tried to slip some language into the record. Well, they spent 2 years trying to slip it into the record, apparently. And then we have what? The president, the newly elected President Clinton, and both houses of Congress controlled by the supporters of the FMLA. If there was any question that this was the intent and that the statute didn't convey it well enough, why would there be any need to slip it in?
I don't think it's appropriate for the court to assume that Congress and the sponsors of this legislation had ulterior motives when all the evidence, all the proper means of legislative history argue in favor of our position. What's the one thing against it? A memo that, as Ms. Beard pointed out, was, as far as we can see, not seen by anyone other than one member of Congress. I did want to speak briefly to the point of the threshold issue, whether or not the court need be concerned about the valid ERISA plan, non-valid ERISA plan. We're operating in a 227 proceeding. Ordinarily, if a court looks at a record and sees something that may or may not have been an accurate legal conclusion, but no one challenged it in a 227 proceeding, that's beyond the scope of the court's purview. The court should be looking at the challenged legal conclusions and shouldn't broadly explore every possible reason that the department decision may or may not be wrong. Now, an exception to that, I think, would take place if, for example, there was affirmative evidence of collusion in some way of trying to bring up an issue to the court that, you know, clearly should not be brought to the court. There's no evidence of that here. Certainly, the Department of Labor and the AFL-CIO were entitled to look at the case and say, golly, this may not actually be a valid ERISA plan when you look at it, but there's so many unanswered questions that the parties may or may not have resolved that it's beyond the scope of the court in a normal 227 review to be looking at.
What's your statutory authority in 227 for that?
I believe it's 227, well, it's generally 227.57 lays out the standards for judicial review. Only disputed issues of fact are to be looked at, and only the conclusions of law. If you wish, Your Honor, I don't know that I put those in there. Ah, thank you. Okay, it would be 227.57. 5 does deal with the erroneous interpretation. If it finds, if the court finds that an erroneous interpretation has occurred, well, if the parties haven't developed the issue at all, it would not be appropriate to be remanding. I might also mention, this is a law where a person asking for family and medical leave has been waiting for several years for a resolution, has won at every level of the proceedings, and if this case were to be remanded back for Aurora to again try to prove ERISA, that would actually serve an injustice. So I don't think that would be appropriate. There's no need to even to reach whether or not there's a valid ERISA plan here. Whether there is or is not an ERISA plan, it makes no difference. Why? Because in 1993, Congress said it makes no difference. The Wisconsin substitution provision is to prevail, regardless of preemption. So remanding it back for a further proceeding would actually require the court to find that Congress did not say that. I'm sorry, my red light is on.
You may finish.
That Congress did not say that, and in fact had a contrary intent, and that Aurora proved that contrary intent. I ask that the decision be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moriarty. Excuse, sir.
I want to clear up a few things before I argue about the legislative history and the statute itself. The clear and manifest intent to overcome the presumption against preemption has to be in the law that does the preempting. In other words, we have to find this court has to find the clear and manifest intent in ERISA. That's the law that preempts. We're not arguing that the FMLA preempts state law. We're arguing that ERISA preempts state law. So that's where the clear and manifest intent has to be. And the United States Supreme Court, in discussing the presumption against preemption, has set out the test, the most recent test, in the Travelers case, with the Blue Cross case. And that's where they said you have to look to the purpose of ERISA, which is to provide a uniform body of employee welfare benefit law.
Ms. Hooser, tell me why I'm wrong. I follow you. I agree with you, you know, that ERISA standing alone is clear. And no problem. But then along comes the later Congress and enacts another statute. And it's a very accepted rule of statutory interpretation that an otherwise unambiguous statute can be rendered ambiguous by another statute. And then our job is to try to harmonize. And at least I went into this case thinking, okay, in that attempt of harmonization, the burden of proving preemption rests with Aurora. And because there is a presumption, and there is a presumption against preemption. There wasn't a presumption against preemption until 1993. Now, why is my thinking off base on that?
Okay, I think that I disagree with your original premise. The presumption against preemption, the Supreme Court has said this in all of their cases, lies with the presumption that ERISA does not preempt state laws. In other words, the presumption is that Congress didn't pass a law with the intent of trying to take over what the state was trying to do. So you have to overcome that presumption against preemption. And as the Department of Labor said, that's been narrowed by the United States Supreme Court. And the United States Supreme Court says we're not going to look at relate to as much. We're going to look to the statute that we're saying is going to be preempted, and we're looking at what is the purpose of ERISA? It's to preserve this federal body of law for employee welfare benefit plans and for pensions. That's the purpose. And so then they look at the statute and they say, does this statute interfere with ERISA's purpose? And if it does, it's preempted. And that was the argument we made earlier. Now, certainly the federal government can come in, Congress can come in and say, well, we're going to make an exception to ERISA preemption, and they have at least on one occasion, and we're going to say that ERISA doesn't preempt state laws that provide greater benefits than federal laws. So now we're not talking about a presumption against preemption anymore. We're talking about, did Congress really say that? And we urge the court to look at the statute. That's the first place to look. And there is nothing in the statute that even remotely suggests that they were talking about an exception to ERISA preemption, because it talks about that it's this act, in other words, the federal FMLA, doesn't preempt more generous state laws. This act is the language. And if I could just point out one more thing, Justice Davlich, this encouragement of more generous leave policies, I'm afraid that everyone is focusing on the title of 2653, and as a principle of statutory construction, we know we can't take the intent of the Congress from the title. We have to look at the Act, and the Act doesn't say that they encourage states to provide more generous leaves. It actually says that the federal FMLA should not be construed to discourage employers from adopting or retaining more generous policies. That's what the more generous provision talked about. And 402B is not surplusage by saying that, let me look at it, that you can't diminish the rights established under this act, because what happened is when Congress passed the federal FMLA, they, in some respects, overrode ERISA by providing benefits that might have otherwise been preempted in state ERISA plans. And let me give you an example. They said, for example, that if you have a pension plan and the term of the pension plan says that you have to be present on December 31st of a year in order to get the contribution for that year, We in the federal FMLA are going to say that if someone is on FMLA leave, that you can't use that provision. You have to give them the credit just as though they were working. So they did make a little exception to the plans. And what 402B is saying is that you can't now use your ERISA-covered pension plan and say, oh, well, we're not going to give you credit because that's not the term of the plan. What that says is you can't use your plan or your collective bargaining as an excuse not to implement the benefits that the federal FMLA provides. And you asked earlier whether the, I believe it was you that asked, you know, whether the federal FMLA, or perhaps it was Justice Prosser, or the state provides more generous leaves. It goes both ways. And in some, it's just different. So,
can I ask a question?
Yes.
Is Aurora a multi-state employer?
Yes.
How many other states does it do business in besides Wisconsin?
How many other states do you know, Mayor Pat? I really don't have that information.
To the best of your knowledge, does any state have more generous family medical leave benefits than Wisconsin does?
Oh, yes. And probably the most generous that I know of is California, where they give you 4 months of pregnancy disability leave, and if you took that pregnancy disability leave, you would the federal FMLA would run concurrently with that leave, so you'd use up both of those leaves. And then they have the California Family Rights Act, which says after your 4 months are over, you can have 3 more months for child bonding leave. So they give up to 7 months in a pregnancy if the mother is disabled.
Is that paid leave?
No, it's unpaid leave. But you can see, this is a good example, now that you brought it up, that a state could, especially in California where they have ballot initiatives and, you know, the legislature isn't really thinking these things out, California could pass a law that says if you have a pension plan your share of the pension plan is based on the hours worked, and the person is on 7 months of our two leaves, you have to give that pension to those people. And what it does is it takes the benefits from the people who earned those benefits, because don't forget, benefits are in lieu of pay. That's why we give benefits. It takes the benefits from the beneficiaries and gives it to someone who's not the beneficiary. And Congress has said, we don't want you to do that. They said it through ERISA, and the United States Supreme Court has affirmed that we don't want states to get in and to meddle with the terms of ERISA plans, because it undermines the purpose of ERISA, which is to protect the employees who are the beneficiaries of the plan. And that is really important. That's the public policy here. We don't want to undermine the purpose of ERISA. And that's why the Supreme Court, in spite of the presumption against preemption, which is strong, that's why the Supreme Court has said when we have a plan that interferes with the administration of plans, we will preempt it. I would like to mention, too, that in 1991, in the Thompson case, of course, the department said that that ERISA would preempt the substitution provision. And the department also took that position in the Bean decision in 1995, and that's in Judge Bean's decision, which all the courts are citing, even though it's unpublished. The Judge Bean's decision says that the department conceded that prior to the passage of the federal FMLA, ERISA would have preempted the state substitution provision. But in addition to looking at the statute, which I think we all agree there's no language in the statute, and I think it is particularly important that there is no rule, and Mr. Moriarty said the reason that there is no rule that the Department of Labor promulgated. There's no rule because Congress didn't give the authority to promulgate the rule, and they have to work on the authority that Congress gave them.
Ms. Huser, is it Huser?
Huser.
I guess this is sort of a global question, or sort of a wrap-up for me.
Okay.
This is the problem I have with your case. When I look at 2651 and 52 and 53, what emerges for me, anyway, is a clear congressional intent to allow states to provide greater benefits in family leave and elsewhere than is provided by FMLA. And then I look at 1144D, the so-called savings clause, and it says nothing in ERISA shall be construed to supersede any law of the United States. It seems to me that that is precisely what you are arguing for.
No, not so, Your Honor. Quite the contrary, because states under, even if you find ERISA preemption, can pass all the more generous benefits they want, and states have. I gave you the example of California, we have the example of Oregon, and we have the example of Puerto Rico, we have Wisconsin, we have New Jersey. There are many states that provide more generous benefits, and ERISA preemption doesn't affect them. The only thing that we're saying here is that the way the Wisconsin substitution provision was drafted, it was drafted to get into an ERISA-covered plan. Wisconsin can pass legislation if it wants to, and it knew in 1991 that there was a finding of ERISA preemption of a substitution provision. They can provide whatever generous benefits they want, including, for example, giving leave for school conferences.
So long as they're not under ERISA.
So long as they, no, here's what the Supreme Court says. So long as you don't interfere with the administration of an ERISA plan, you can provide any minimum labor standard that you want. But it has to be of general application, and it can't be written in such a way that it interferes with an ERISA-covered plan. That's the line in the sand that the Supreme Court drew.
But then, aren't you if you prevail in this, aren't you then creating a situation in which, no matter what the state legislature says with respect to family leave benefits, an employer will be able to get around that legislation by getting themselves within an ERISA plan?
Well, my answer to that would be, in 1991 we had the Thompson case. And that case said, the department has interpreted the substitution provision to mean that ERISA preempts it. Now, you would have expected, if what you're saying is true, that employers would have flocked to ERISA-covered plans. As a matter of fact, in our law firm, we were waiting for it. And it didn't happen because many, many employers, I would say most employers, it's certainly the ones we deal with, they don't want to bother with an ERISA-covered plan. It requires them to set aside funds. It requires them to do reporting. There are a lot of administrative burdens with an ERISA-covered plan. And so those employers said, yeah, that's nice. Tell us about VIVAs. That's what we heard. But I didn't have one client that asked us to set up an ERISA-covered plan. Not one single client. Because it isn't so much fun to get involved with these IRS reporting and everything like that. So that's the truth of it.
Now that you mention it, does this Aurora Medical Plan or the sick leave plan, does it report to ERISA? Does it...
Yes, it has to report to and has to follow the IRS regulations. That's why we said Judge DeLeo's decision was wrong, because she made some assumptions that were not correct under the IRS. But I'd like to make another point on the legislative history. Everyone talks about there's no House report, but there is, and it's on page 357 of the department's appendix. And the thing about the House report, which is as authoritative as any Senate report, that it absolutely leaves out any mention of non-preemption. And the other thing that's important, so you know, that you have to consider that equally. Those two reports conflict. And the other thing is, when they're talking about 401 preemption, I'm sorry, it's 401B preemption, they are saying, even in the Senate report, that it's only Section 401B, which is 2651, which...
Does the House report say that ERISA trumps FEMLA?
No, that's the thing. The Senate report says FEMLA trumps ERISA in two pages on page 38 of the Senate report. But if you look at the comparable explanation in the House report, that language is missing. There's a reason that language is missing, I would contend. And so you can't look at it and say, well, this is definitive legislative history. That's only in one house, in the miscellaneous section of one report, and it refers to section 401B, which is the non-preemption section. It doesn't refer to 402B, the so-called greater benefits section. So even in the, if you took the Senate report, it doesn't make the connection that respondents are asking you to make. At least Congress didn't make that connection. At least the Senate didn't make that connection. And the other thing about the letter from the Congressional Research Service of the Library of Congress, the parties, the respondents have asserted that that's not authoritative legislative history, and they cite the Kelly case, Kelly v. Robinson case from the Supreme Court, saying for that proposition. But if you read Kelly v. Robinson, Kelly v. Robinson was talking about comments that were made in hearings that weren't made by members of Congress, and they said that's not authoritative source. But in the New Haven Board of Education v. Terrence Bell that the department cites, they cite with approval letters printed in the record during the Senate debate on the conference report, that those are sources of legitimate sources of legislative history. So now we have the Senate legislative history saying one thing very briefly, and Mackey says we can't take just a comment in a Senate report unless we see some corresponding language. We all agree there's no corresponding language here. And then we have the House report that doesn't have this legislative history that the Senate report has, and plus the letter. And at best, you have very conflicting legislative history, and you have no language in the statute and no rule by the department that was entrusted to promulgate the rules. And the reason they didn't is because Congress didn't give them authority. Without that authority, this court should find that ERISA does preempt Wisconsin substitution provision. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Huster. That concludes our argument in 98-1546. And the court wants to thank all counsel who have participated in oral argument in the briefs for a job well done on a difficult case. Thank you.